Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
The Team Never Quit podcast is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. Partner up with Navy Federal to pay down credit card debt. You can learn more about this at NavyFederal.org.
I was in a van one day leaving Bamsey. There was, many of us wounded warriors in there, so to speak, and everybody was missing something. And one of the guys looked around and he said, damn, he said, all of us together make like one whole man, maybe two.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you everyone for listening, watching, viewing, and please hit that subscribe button if you enjoy listening to our shows. So before we dive into today's special guest, let's kick it off with our Patreon question of the day. If you were going to describe your high school experience in three words, what would they be?
I hated high school.
What? I loved high school.
I went to four different high schools. So I did not have a typical high school life. We moved around a lot. I absolutely hated high school, and I could not wait to just get out in the world and be an adult.
Okay.
I did.
That's why she's so tough. I was like, all right.
I hated high school. Like I always worked like at least two jobs after high school because I didn't go to the same school my whole high school. So I didn't have
Catch a rhythm.
Yeah, I never had a rhythm.
I don't know. How about you, brother?
Yeah, I grew up in a community where we had a big school, but outside of the town was like farming schools. It's like one of my friends graduated with a class of like 30 people. My class, I think we were about 80, close to 80 students. Anyway, one of my best friends, he was over here visiting the other day. He said he was from up north somewhere. And his graduating class, there was almost 2,000 students. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'd never even heard of that. I mean, honestly, I mean, I visited people, but I guess now at our age, we don't always talk about high school. Usually talking about military or something, but... Right. When that does come up, it's kind of neat to, hear how people grew up.
I graduated with 50 people. And it was very small. But Marcus graduated, you had like 600 people.
No, I had 144.
Oh, I thought you had a big school. Mm-hmm.
144.
That's why you know
everybody. That's a
pretty
big class compared to ours.
Yeah.
It's huge now. I grew up in Willis, Texas, and it's world famous. And I had the best childhood. I had the most amazing experience. The people I grew up with in my town and in my school made it so much fun that people would come from other towns to hang out.
Act like they're in high school.
And we still act like that today. If you run across anybody and they say that they're a wildcat, they are. There's something in the water out there, whatever it does to us, man, but we are a tight-knit crew. I mean, we call each other and beat each other to death, man, but we freaking love each other. And every time our crew gets together, we talk about how wonderful our childhood was growing up at that place.
Yeah, you did have like
And everyone knows it. This is not a secret. Everyone around the surrounding areas knows how much fun we had growing up. They wrote stories about it in the papers before there was even a book on me.
There was. There's.
Thank you.
I actually find.
That's how you can look it up.
I find newspaper articles.
How great
articles,
is that?
I find newspaper articles of Marcus from high school. And I'm like, nobody even thought about being in the paper when I was in high school. Like, it wasn't a thing. There's Marcus on the front page for jumping over four cars in, like, a karate kick. Or for saving some cop's life on the side of the road that he gave CPR to.
Let me tell you something. The kids I grew up with, man, I went to a graduation the other day. And I was watching the kids up there, and they were talking about missing each other and the times that they had. When I graduated, I truly missed them. And that's why we still stay in touch. I may not talk to one of them, but I damn sure talk to somebody who does. Matter of fact, I heard a rumor that one of my classmates died. This is funny now. One of them died. I mourned his death. He showed up to the reunion. And I even told him I thought he was dead. I mean, so many people die around me. I just assumed that he had died, you know? And I kind of, and when he showed up, I'll never forget, he walked to the door. I was like, bro, I thought you were freaking dead. And he's like, nope, right here. It's like, sweet. Glad. Here's a beer, man.
I did that with one of my classmates. I thought he was dead. Somebody told me he got kicked by a bull and killed. And at least maybe that was their perception.
Which is believable,
what they had
heard.
Yeah, and then I went back home to visit some folks. And anyway, they're like, man, we should go see Cecil. And I'm like, Cecil? I'm like, what, like visit his grave? And they're like, what? And I was like, yeah. I was like, I heard he was dead, man. And they're like, nah, bro, he's like working for the sheriff's department. I'm like, what?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, you know, I spent like probably 10 years thinking the dude was dead.
Hey, that,
and
that's
come
a thing.
To find out,
that does
for the
something to you,
department.
Right? That promotes a feeling. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
exactly.
And actually, when you fix it, when your buddy dies, you find his life. Like, there's an emotion that goes with that you'll never ever get anywhere else.
So, did you give him a hug?
Yeah. Well, hell yeah, I hugged him.
Yeah.
I stared at him. I was like, damn, dude.
Oh my gosh.
And he looked good too. He looked real good, actually. I was like, damn, I thought you were freaking. Anyways,
but you know, to be honest, though, that youth that we experienced in those small towns, and I think that's what shaped us, though, to be who we are. And, you know, growing up in a small, I'm not to say that, you know, big cities and bigger classes don't have their own challenges. What I'm saying is, you know, it's like, you know, like listening to my friend talk about graduating 2,000 people, he said, I probably knew maybe 100 of them. And he's like, so, you know, it's like I really wasn't connected with a lot of people. I had, you know, like a few people that were close to me, but other than that, that was it. And, you know, and I honestly couldn't even imagine, because I felt like I knew like every person in my class and every person in the high school almost intimately. And they knew me intimately. Right. I couldn't do anything on the weekend that somebody didn't find out.
Oh, hell no. And
before Monday morning.
Yeah, knew what your family did. It was all the way we looked at it was like we were all in high school together. We were just separated by age. Mm-hmm. Like there was 144 of us that were 18. We were allowed to leave. That kind of thing. Same as you. That's how it is in Texas, man. It was great.
Yeah.
I freaking loved it, man.
Hunter grew up. He went to the
I know
same
sucker,
school.
Had a good time, man.
He went to the same school from pre-K to 12th. So he knew everybody very, very well. And he played sports. And they went to state his senior year. You had
state
a
champion.
Great high
school. They just
won
go,
state.
They win it.
You won state.
That's right.
Yes.
Beat the mess out of him. What's up?
Yeah.
Good job, son. I was proud of you. First
so did
time
you
ever.
Like your high school years?
Yeah, I would say that. It wasn't even just the school, but it was everything about it, like traveling. We did a lot of that in high school as well. And just the friends. I mean, I still have the same friend group from seventh, eighth grade.
Yeah.
And
somehow, which I never understood, Hunter made friends with, because he went to a small private school, he made friends with all the public school kids, but he didn't know them. How did you meet those people?
I taught him that. That came
how?
From me.
Doesn't
matter. Just walk outside and start introducing. I was like, never meet a stranger.
I never understood how he had so many friends that went to not just like our local public schools, but all the way down in El Campo. Like there was
through sports and parties.
Yeah, it was weird.
Hunter
never
like
meets
Campo. A
stranger. Parties, don't say that. Yeah. He's at the library and he's studying, right?
He never meets a stranger. He's literally friends with everybody he meets. So that's good. All right. That was a good Patreon question.
All right, brother, man. Thanks for coming in and doing this. We got a file on, on you and everything.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, you bet. You look great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I've been practicing. I stand in front of the mirror a lot, you know, making sure my hair looks good.
It does.
You know, making sure my ears look good. I polish my little studs pretty regular.
You got one of those perfect heads, though. So I feel like you complaining about not having hair is not a thing for you guys. Some of y'all have that.
Perfect.
Well, mine's shaved down. It doesn't look right. It just doesn't. I don't know. I got too many dents from falling down mountains and crap like that, but you got one of them perfect domes, so.
Axe asked me the other day what you would look like with a buzz cut.
I look meanish, mean. Dude, I look. I have the horns and everything.
It's weird. Well, I have to agree with you though. I am a little jealous of some of those dudes. It's got like that very symmetrical round head, and then when they shave it, and then they have this like really long beard. I can't even do that because you know it's like the scar tissue right here. I can't grow a whiskers there. So this morning it looked kind of cool. I had like this 2-3 day, you know, little gray salt and pepper thing going on, and it looks good. But after that, I have like a, I don't know, like a Harvey Two-Face Batman character thing going on.
Yeah.
And it just don't feel right, you know?
So I got some weird scar stuff going too. Here's another thing. I noticed that when the salt and pepper stubble starts growing in, there's a few days it makes you look like a crazy sumbitch. Like you've been drunk and on a bench. You know what I'm talking about? As opposed to when we're younger and it's all black, it always looks good. But then as you get older, there's that phase that you have to grow when the white's coming in.
Like Jack Nicholson on...
whatever crazy white looks like with that guy.
Yeah.
Well, there's like this perfect morning when you wake up and everything just looks good.
There is. That's a thing. I got to start clocking that.
One day, though.
One day, yeah. It doesn't last.
Maybe the next day, but you're pushing it on the next day.
Yeah. You got to time that for like important events. Like wedding, anywhere you want to go look cool, you got to back the clock up a little bit and let him mark it down. So I know that this thing's going to be on time. I never thought about that, bro, that you said that. That's hilarious. And yeah, the guys who can grow the perfect beards with the bald head, F those guys, man. Who cares about them, man? That's not even fair.
I don't know. I'm jealous. I'm just going to say it. I'm jealous. And I shouldn't be. That's not a big Christian of me, but hey, you know.
Whatever.
I'm pretty good the way I am, though. So a lot of people ask me about these little titanium studs in my head. They're actually for my prosthetic ears, and I feel bad that I didn't bring my ears, but I already have them packed up. I'm getting ready to go on a trip. But yeah, so a lot of people ask me, they're like, is that for your hearing? You know, is it like cochlear kind of stuff or something? I'm like, no, they're just really cosmetic. And then I've met this one person at the airport, and I was delayed for whatever reason. I stopped and have some dinner and grabbed a drink. And anyways, I could tell, I was like, she's cool. I really like her. Because she goes, oh, my God, that's so cool. I can't believe you had your ears removed. And I was thinking, I didn't really have a choice. How should I play this? Because I was single at the time. You know, I was thinking, you know, she's kind of freaky. I like this, you know. I'm like,
oh, my God.
No, that's some kinky shit right there. I never even thought about it. She thought you had them removed?
Oh, my God.
That's hardcore.
I did not have them removed.
No, I know, but I'm saying that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I was thinking, how do I play this? You know, because she had like tats and everything everywhere and had some piercings, which I thought was super cool. But, when she thought that I had my ears removed, I'm like, should I be play like this badass? Like, yeah, I didn't need them anyway, you know. All they do is block wind and rain. I don't need that crap, you know. But then I finally told her, I was like, yeah, I have prosthetic ears. I even have elf ears. Well, I call them Dr. Spock ears, but you know.
Oh my gosh.
I like when you wear those all the time.
Because when you pull them off in front of people, dude, they freak out.
Oh, I bet.
Oh my gosh.
Do you wear the Spock ones all the time? Because that would be cool.
Yeah, I do have Spock ears. I have, and it took me a little while to talk them into it because they were like, you know how much these cost? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, but I'm asking for Spock ears. And they were like, well, you probably wouldn't even wear them.
Oh, yes. They
were having a hard time justifying it. And I was like, guarantee I will wear them. Probably more than I would my normal ears.
Absolutely.
So.
That is so funny.
So is
you want to see them?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we do want to see the Spock ears.
Oh, okay.
You know how we are, man. Military guys, it's kind of like a badge.
Mm-hmm.
It's an earned thing. Like the guys with the prosthetics and I'm not saying it's a competition, but it kind of is. Because like now with our generation, it's different. Back in the day when guys would get a splinter, they'd have 1,000 surgeries to hold on to a leg that wasn't even there. Now guys will just get a cut and they'll be like, okay, you can take that leg and I want that sucker right there. And and you literally, it's a bat. It's almost like wearing their medals all the time. That's what's really going on when they walk in the room. And I am a prime example of that. When one of them suckers walks in the room, I will stand at attention, because that it's a level of pain that each person's gone through in the military. That's what really separates us from the other ones, is the amount of pain. And those ribbons we wear on our chest denote that. And if you got somebody walking around who's always wearing their medal, like him, yes, that means something in our world. It absolutely does. And my question is there a difference when you're wearing your, like, hearing-wise, or are those strictly for to hold your glasses up?
So I actually had somebody, I met an audiologist out of California. Me and him, we just hit it off, you know, like best buds kind of thing. And he asked me what one of my biggest challenges was, you know, being a burn survivor. And I told him, I said, ironically, one of my biggest challenges is my hearing loss. And so he went the extra mile to make sure that I had top of the line, good hearing devices with Bluetooth and everything. That's actually how I'm communicating with you guys now, is my hearing aids connected directly to the Bluetooth, which isn't necessarily uncommon nowadays. But when I went to do the testing, he flew me all the way out to his office and we did the testing there, and he did it with the ears and without the ears. And believe it or not, the ears actually do either capture or block ambient noise, and it does help the hearing, but just a little bit. Now, the unfortunate part is that I have a trade-off, and you know how that goes. You know, there's always a trade-off, it seems.
Yeah, that's
like
what I was wondering.
If I wear the prosthetic ears often, especially during the summer, I get sweat and stuff like that, you know, and it gets kind of nasty. And I'm very prone to infection, because if these get loose in like a little bit, then the body starts trying to reject it, and it automatically starts putting infection stuff there, or what, the blood cells.
Because it's foreign,
so
right?
It's a challenge.
Yep. So most people don't think about that.
There's always a trade-off.
Yeah, so most people don't think about that when it's half in and half out. It's like it's still foreign to the body. And my question with the ocular, with the cochlear design of of the external ear, when you're wearing different shapes, does it give you different hearing abilities? Have you practiced that yet?
I mean, I think it just more like blocks out the ambient stuff, you know, like outside noise. And
so it's not what you can hear, is what you don't have to listen to. I'm curious as to the shape of the ears, because you're a perfect example of how this. To explain this, like with the shape of the ear, does it catch sound differently? Have you noticed that? Because you actually have different ones, or is it not that you that things can hear better? It's that they don't hear a bunch of stuff; they only hear what they need to hear. I'm just curious.
I think the cartilage. Be honest, I think the cartilage actually plays a role, and so when you have just rubber up there, it doesn't. I mean, it's like I said, it blocks maybe the ambient noise. But I don't know that it actually captures the noise here. To be honest, I mean, I don't really know how that works.
You know what?
I feel like the cartilage plays a role.
I never thought about that until you said that, because I've studied medicine long enough to know kind of what we're talking about. But your ear, the exterior ear, is like an antenna. And that cartilage vibrates and catches whatever kind of vibration hits that sucker. It rattles it, and all that goes in through those three little bones in the ear and interprets that. So yeah, that makes sense. I never thought about it until you said it like that. But I mean, I don't know if that's on point, but it sounds right.
So let's talk about you growing up. You said you grew up in a small town. Let's go back to hear your story.
Oh well, thank you, and I know that. I've been extremely blessed. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. But I'm going to start with telling you a good Texas story. And it kind of involves the ears, but it also involves, I guess, getting to know me a little bit too. So I grew up in a small town called McCamey, Texas, when I was younger, up until about middle school. And then I moved to Coleman, Texas, which is over by Abilene. And so West Texas versus Central Texas, you know, there's a stark difference.
Huge. But I love different worlds.
I know, that's right. And you know, that's actually really unique, because Texas seems to have like all these different climates and regions that, you know, it just brings it all together. It's like you can drive a couple hours and be in the desert and drive a couple hours in the opposite direction and be on the coast. So, I say a couple hours. We know that's not true. You know, it's like 5-6 hours. Right, right. You know?
Yeah, that's a couple in Texas.
Anyway, so one of the trips, I got invited out to McCamey, and I knew that I was going out there to the desert. Well, me being a burn guy, I have a hard time regulating my body temperature because the scar tissue acts like wearing a jacket all the time. It just doesn't breathe. And I have a tendency to overheat and get sick. So on my trip out there, I was like, you know what? I'm going to stop and get me a cowboy hat today. You know, it helped keep the sun off of me. But I noticed that I had my cowboy boots on, had my belt buckle on. Felt kind of cool, you know, going home for a change. And I was like, I'm going to get me a hat. Well, I stopped at the Western Wear store out there. You probably know them, Woods Boots. You know Woods Boots out there in Odessa or along that area?
I don't. No, I don't.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a two-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Oh, man, I love Woodsburg. A lot of people know it. It's that if you get to Colorado City, there's one that actually looks like a fort that's got the wooden post and everything. It looks so cool. Anyway, so I had planned on stopping there, but I didn't make that one. Got into Odessa, and I was about to meet my friends. Went to the Western Wear store, and I told the little girl, I want to get a hat, but I don't know what size my head is. And I said, let's just start small and work our way up. Like, my head, it really isn't that big. And anyway, so she brought over a couple of hats. The first hat she handed me, and it was like a child's hat, had the elastic band in it. And of course, it just barely sat on the crown of my head. That's not it. Well, I was pulling that one off. Well, she had that other hat. She had another hat in her hand. And I think like a good salesperson, she figured she could just size me up, right? Well, she set that hat up there and popped it down. Well, when she did, both my ears popped off.
Oh, my
gosh. They hit the floor and they were bouncing around.
Bro.
And I hadn't had my ears very long, bro. I like to die.
Are you kidding
me? I was so embarrassed.
You were embarrassed. Oh, I don't even worry about you, bro. What would she do?
That's good. That's good. That's a good story. Too.
I know you're good.
So, you know, and you know, San Antonio, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad because a lot of guys and gals went through their recovery there, missing legs and arms and everything else, you know. And so San Antonio is kind of used to seeing guys like me. And anyway, but there I am in this Western Horse Store out in West Texas. And you're right. I was putting myself back together because I look like a hot mess.
Good one.
Come on.
I got you, man. I was super, man. Good job.
So anyway, I'm grabbing my ears and I'm putting them back on. And anyway, I was bent over a little bit. I looked up and that little girl was just like, you know, I mean, we scared her to death. I scared her to death and I didn't mean to. And I didn't even know what to say, man. I mean, this I hadn't had my ears probably about 2 weeks at this time. And I honestly, I don't know. When I wear my ears, I feel like I got a lot of wind drag. I mean, it's like walking around with all kinds of wind drag. So when I'm like this, I'm really aerodynamic. I have to be careful not to, you know, walk past two people, you know, to walk past people too fast. They'll think I'm a speedster or something. But anyway, I put my ears back on and I could see that the little girl was just speechless, right? I didn't even know what to say. So the first thing that came to my mind was, I bet that happens a lot to you, right?
Nice.
She was not having it, bro.
Nice. Is this the same speechless. Store that's off No Country for Old Men? Have you seen that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Is that it? Do you know?
That would be a good example. It looked like that out there in West Texas.
Okay, so I know that one. I'm going to have to look that up, man. They're going to bust my ass for not knowing a freaking store in Texas with cowboy boots and hats.
That is so funny. So did she cry? Because I think I would have cried.
Well, I could see that she was speechless and she didn't know what to say. So I just let her off the hook. I was like, you know, maybe I'll just look around. So I didn't get a hat that day, which is actually one of the questions a lot of people ask me. They're like, well, did you get the hat? And I'm like, I did not get the hat. It was just didn't seem appropriate because for one, maybe I needed to order smaller ears. I didn't know. You know, this is my first time having ears in quite a while.
Well, I guess I'll be back.
I'm telling my buddies about it. One of my buddies is a Baptist preacher. The other one, he's a Vietnam veteran, and he was the one that coordinated the veteran event that we were doing. I'm sitting there, and you know how we poke fun at each other being veterans, you know, like kind of like you were talking about the badge, you know, but at the same time, one of our coping mechanisms is a bit of a dark humor.
Absolutely.
The Vietnam veteran, though, he was the one consoling me. I figured it'd be the Baptist preacher, but the Baptist preacher looks at me and he goes, "Dude, you could have got a free hat." I was like, "What?" And he said, "Bro, when your ears fell off, you should have grabbed your head and went, ah!"
Right? And hauled ass out of there.
And then hauled ass out of there.
I was like, "Hey, look, instead of getting a bigger hat, I decided I'd go change the size of my ears." Hit her with that next time you walk in and just see the look on her face, man.
Speaking of the size of the ear, the day that I went to get sized for my ears, the lady was like, "Hey, you know, we're going to walk around and I let you look at ears." And I was thinking, what is there, like a room of ears that I can pick from? No, she was actually walking me around the clinic at seeing if I could pick an ear off of somebody that worked there. And I was like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with that.
Oh, my gosh.
It just felt really weird.
To mimic the ear.
So did they design it off of pictures of your old one, like from pictures when you had your original?
That's what I did. Yeah. Because I told her, I was like, well, it'd be cool if I had my ears. But apparently I had really big ears. So I ended up having to find a smaller set.
Oh, my God.
Well, that's funny, man.
That is so funny.
But you look like I had, oh, yes, that toe mirrors, did you?
Yeah.
I know. I'm full of it today.
Look right? Like a truck
that
with the door open.
So funny.
Bro, that's, yeah. Those are the moments I'm talking about. Like, if anybody was to bring those out, that's the thing with veterans. Because usually in those moments, if you're dealing with a civilian, if that was another veteran, it'd have been on. If I was there, hell, right? Like some of our guys are so good at, man, some of our guys can pull some stuff like you can, and the girls can too, for sure.
I was in a van one day leaving Bamsey, and there was, you know, many of us wounded warriors in there, so to speak, and everybody was missing something. And one of the guys looked around and he said, "Damn," he said, "all of us together make like one whole man, maybe two."
Oh my God.
A bunch of spare parts running around. Yeah, we got rooms full of them now.
Oh my gosh. So growing sorry, I have to keep this on a task because of our timeline. So growing up, did you come from a military family? How did you know you wanted to go into the military?
Well, that's a really good question. I did come from a military family. My dad and my grandfather both served. My father was a Vietnam veteran. My grandfather served World War II, Korea, and served during Vietnam. My uncles and I had various cousins and that sort of thing served throughout the military. So it was around me. The weird thing was, though, I didn't really join until I was 27 years old. Felt like it was an opportunity missed because growing up out there in West Texas, you know, it was pretty wild. You know, my dad being a veteran, we spent a lot of time with the American Legion. Well, the Legion out there was more like a bar.
And it, that was it is a bar. Where
yeah, exactly. You know, and that's where we were. You know, we spent a lot of time with the American Legion. So I grew up in a pretty rough atmosphere, but, you know, I still feel very blessed, and I didn't let the things that the challenges and the experiences that I had then define who I was. And fortunately, you know, after 9/11, I was determined to join. I was like, you know what, whatever happens, I got to join. And I was just going to go door to door until somebody accepted me. And the army recruiter, he was pretty happy to see me. He was going, "Boy, I'm gonna get this guy." No.
How good of a salesman are those freaking recruiters? I mean, some of them guys can talk you. Think about that. Them guys talk you into a completely changing your life. Some of them are good at that. Everyone hates them going in there, but every one of us got tagged by one of them. Think about it. Everybody bitches about them guys and gals, man, but we all got hit by them. Mine was brilliant. Oh, yeah. Mine was one of my own. I still talk to that fool. God dang, man. We'll get off topic quick.
I talked to my recruiter too, man. But, you know, I think it has a different, like with me, I had a different focus. You know, when I joined in the military, I was already 27. So I had a little life experience and I was really trying to make a good choice. I wasn't really just necessarily wanting to join whatever they put in front of me.
Yeah.
I knew that I wanted combat arms. Originally, I was thinking about the infantry, you know, because they were talking about fast promotions and that sort of thing. But honestly, I'd considered the Navy because my grandfather was in the Navy and he absolutely loved it. Unfortunately, he only spent 3 years in the Navy, though. He said the submarines scared the shit out of him during World War II. So
submarines scare anybody.
He said, "I wanted off of ships. We went into the Army, so we reclassed.
Yeah.
And went into armor.
I think a lot of those guys reclassed after we got back from the wars, it seemed like. That's when you see a lot of those cross raids, stuff like that. And the sub force, that's for anybody who doesn't know anything about the military, the submarine force is the hardest duty. That's the hardest detail in any military operation is being underwater like that. Them guys and gals, they don't get any, I think there's girls on there now, but anyways, that's the toughest detail.
Now, I was never on a submarine, but my cousin, he was a nuclear tech on a submarine. And he was telling me that they offered him $50,000 to re-up when he was at the end of his contract. And he told him absolutely not because he didn't want to go back on a sub.
Okay, so they eat the best. They have the best living conditions when they're on land, even the enlisted guys. And then they eat like royalty on the sub, underwater. That's the one thing you do. And you get all the movies, all the new stuff. It's unbelievable what they got. Depending on the boat, the sub that you're on, but they eat like royalty. That was the only blessing we had when we were on there. Because when we were on there, man, oh, they loved to mess with us. They'd stick us in the torpedo racks. Anyways, yeah, sub force, we love you, man. that's that dark water Navy, man. They're badass.
And so you were on a sub?
Oh, yes.
Were you on a sub at all?
Not I figured you were.
Many times. Right? Yeah, multiple times. Never assigned to a submarine. We were assigned to a boat, but the longest I ever did was almost 20-something days. That's the longest I was ever underwater. I never had to go. Like, we would helo in, they'd drop us in the water, and then a submarine would literally come pick us up out in the middle of the ocean.
That's badass.
Real badass. Man. Most people don't even know that's one of our rides, but it is. And the way we operate with them is probably the most hardcore joint operation that they do is us with them, is when they pair us up. And, man, let me tell you something. This is a group. The craziest stories I ever had, ever tell, come from underwater with them. Hands down.
Wow.
Hands down. That place will kill you quick. Yeah, it's badass. All right. How many siblings you got?
You know, speaking of that, I wanted to take a moment. Even though that you and I have met, you know, here, there, and every now and then, I don't think that I've ever had the opportunity to tell you thank you very much for your service. I don't know if people tell you that on a regular basis. I know people tell me that sometimes because I wear my scars. And, you know, for guys like you and I, you know, we're out there. And in my opinion, we're representing our people. You know, we're trying to encourage better quality of life for them, better opportunities, and that sort of thing about what we do. Being out there encouraging people, hey, this is what we went through, and we're not the only ones. But I just want to tell you thank you, not just for your military and the service, but what you do now. And thank you so much, Melanie, for everything that you do to support him and help him along in his journey and his mission. Thank you both very much for what you do. Much respect for your family. Welcome.
Thank you.
We have the same respect for you. Yeah. Thank you.
My wife, it's like we talk about it. My wife makes me talk about it out loud. The greatest part about being a SEAL, being a specialist, is imagine I got to work in almost as many jobs as I possibly could in the military. It's like we get to learn all everyone's jobs. So we get to hang out with everybody from all different branches. That was the best part about it, come to find out. Like when we're in, there's the bravado. And when I'd show up, you know, we'd always I'm stealing information. But then when you get out, you realize how cool that was. I don't know.
Absolutely. It's weird. You know, and you're right, though, because I noticed that, too, like in Germany. My first duty station was in Germany with the Big Red One. And when I got there, you know, everybody was kind of griping about having to lift heavy stuff and do this and that. And I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Look at the size of these guns. This is like the coolest shit in the world.
That's what I thought, too.
Working on tanks and Bradleys. I mean, who drives a tank? Who gets to ride in a tank? You know,
who the hell drives a tank?
This is cool. People are like, oh, man, we got to go to the motor pool. And I'm like, bro, I want to learn every inch of this baby because I want to go out and use it.
So speaking of, let's get on to your military career. You signed up with the Army with your recruiter, and did you go straight into the 10th Mountain Division, or did you start somewhere else?
That's another really good question. You've done this before, Melanie, I can tell.
Sorry.
Talking to the boss.
Got it.
That is really a good question. I when I joined, as I said, I was 27. I knew what I was getting into, and I told the Army recruiter, I said, just sign me up for the max because I'm probably going to be a lifer. You know, because I really felt like if I can get in, I felt like it was a great opportunity. You know, some people are like, well, I'll test the water for like 2 or 3 years. No, I want it in the military. I'm like, I want to join. I signed up for six, my very first contract. And the only thing that I got in my contract was just that I was going to be a Cab Scout. I didn't get anything special because I had to have a couple of different waivers. Of course, they were like, you're lucky you're getting in the military. And you know what? For me, that was good enough because I knew what I wanted. I wanted combat arms. I wanted boots on the ground and I wanted a rifle in my hand. And that's what I got. So I joined the cavalry, went to Germany, as I said, you know, for my first duty station. And after that deployment with the Big Red One, which was mechanized tanks, Bradleys, it was really an aggressive campaign. We didn't see any action play for the first 2 or 3 months. But once we started working in our areas, you know, we started experiencing small arms and that sort of thing, a few IEDs. But I guess one of the biggest challenges from that deployment was in Bakuba, and they called it Bloody Easter or something like that. And anyway, we were engaged pretty much for 3-4 days straight. Ended up getting dysentery because we were just like running back-to-back missions. We got attached to some guys as we were driving through. They were all light. All they had was light Humvees and an artillery group. And they asked if we could help. Anyway, so yeah, we helped for like 4 days. We were running mission, just back-to-back mission. And we all looked like, you know, we'd been through it by the end of that week. Anyway, we finally got a hot shower and everything, and I was so damn sick. And then we had to go to the next duty station. But that deployment, man, I learned a lot. You know, I mean, it allowed me to become a good leader to help some of those younger guys coming in, which after that deployment, I went to the 10th Mountain Division. I went there as an E5, young leader. And I loved it, man. I really did. The 10th Mountain Division was light infantry style. It was quite a bit of difference, you know, from the mechanized. But I enjoyed it just as much. We'd worked primarily around Baghdad, all that area down there in the Sunni Triangle.
Oh yeah.
Good area, right?
Yeah. Thought about buying some land there when last time I was there. And we used to joke about that all the time. We're driving through. Like, hey, there's a nice. I bet that's for sale.
I'll take that palace.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, those things. The freaking palaces there, man. You got to hand it to them, man. They can build. Like, if we weren't spending most of our time fighting and tearing everything down, can you imagine what this place would look like?
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
No, I can't imagine what it looked like back in the day before wars and before had to that down.
I really feel like it would have been beautiful.
Oh, you know, man. Because, you know, it's Babylon. And, Iraq, man, and Baghdad's Babylon. And you can kind of see it there. I mean, that you can see how that place could look like that, man, the way that some of the structures that they have now. But you're right. I remember, bro, the missus and I were on the Truman the other day. And, you know, the kid that drives that 17, 18 years old. I was like, when you said it, it's funny, I got lucky to get into the military. There's nothing lucky about getting in the damn military. You're lucky to get out. Like, if you see a veteran, like that sucker's lucky, right? I was like, the average age of the kick-ass force that goes over is 22 to 23. That's who we are, right? And then our leaders are 25. You're an old man at 32. And then the gods and the stars, they're, you know, that's in their 40s and stuff. You don't think about that when you're in. And the way I explained getting out, I was like, imagine going to, as soon as you join the military, it's like walking into the gym. And then you start working out day one, week one, minute one. When you come out of the military is when you actually come out of that gym. and the pain and the soreness and all the aches and problems that you have the minute you get out is how hard you worked while you were in. And it takes a while to get over that. But once you do, you can't imagine what in the hell you look like and what it built. Look what it did to us. Look what that damn gym did to me and you.
Yeah.
And that's the best way I've ever heard it explained when guys are coming out like, hey, look, man, we just been in the war gym. Man, we barely made it out. And it's one by one. They didn't stick us all out at once. We all came out one by one, man, single file. It's crazy.
So how long did you serve with the 10th Mountain Division?
With the 10th, it was probably about 2-3 years, somewhere along in there, because I spent 8 years total in the military. I was my first duty station, Big Red One, so I think I was in Germany right at 3 years, and then so the rest of the time was at the 10th Mountain Division, or I spent about 2 years in recovery, so 8, 2, 3, 5, so about 3 years at the 10th as well, and 2 deployments, and of course, you know, on that second deployment, I was injured by a roadside bomb, and you're right. You know, my body, I feel it. You know, I feel like I came out of the gym, but after also getting an ass whooping or two.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Something extra in there for you, right? Yeah, check.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, talk about that. Go ahead. No, talk about it.
Can you tell us about that second deployment with the 10th?
Yeah, the second deployment, you know, I gave you a little clip of that first deployment. The second deployment, like I said, was light. Working down there around Eusebio Mamadia. They're not fans of us, of course, you know, and, you know, the first deployment, we didn't really run into a lot of people that were hostile at us. We worked with the Kurdish because we were up north around the Jabhat Hamra, up above Tikrit. You know, Tikrit was still pretty hostile, but some of the Kurdish that we worked with were super cool. And actually, you know, I want to say a lot of the people that we interacted with in Iraq, I gained a lot of respect for some of those people, you know. Some of them I don't have as much respect for, because if you're not willing to help yourself, then, you know, I don't have much for you in a sense. You know, there were a lot of good people over there that took pride in their country, took pride in what they did.
Great people.
They worked hard.
Yeah, yeah. Great
and
people.
They didn't mind us being there to help them. You know, whereas others, you know, they just seen it as an opportunity to, you know, I guess try to pick a fight with somebody. But anyway, going back to working down there south of Baghdad, in that area, it was extremely hostile. Therefore, the first 3, 4, 5 months that we were there, I mean, every day, literally every day, there was an IED went off in our AO somewhere, our area of operation. And we had several losses as far as vehicles and that sort of thing. We had a few people get WIA. Fortunately, no KIAs until one incident. And then we lost a young man. And I ended up going to replace him in that platoon. So being the replacement guy was pretty hard. But once I earned my merit, you know, we had a couple of engagements that I was able to help out with, so to speak. I don't want to toot my horn on it. But, you know, like I said, man, you know, when you get in those situations, you have to do what you have to do. And I feel very fortunate that we made it through it. Shortly after that, we were working, it was in February of 2007. We were working down in Eusebio Mamadia, really trying to get control of that area. Because like I said, it was out of hand with IEDs. IEDs were going off all the damn time. We were having small arms fire all the time. And it was a farming area, you know? It wasn't like being in the city. So we really started working hard in that area. All the roads were named after heavy metal bands, yeah. Rightfully so.
All right.
You know, because it was all big IED holes all the way up and down the roads, man. It was crazy.
I have a question. So do you, when you're in an area that's just littered with IEDs, do you have EOD guys with you?
Yeah, we had EOD out there. Yet, you know, they were so overwhelmed with the amount of IEDs in the road. Not too far. I want to say between Baghdad, if I remember correctly, in between Baghdad and the area that we were working was one of the main interstates. And so they had calls out there all the time. And of course, since that was where they did a lot of the log packs and routes for, what do you call them? I said it right, log pack, right?
Yeah.
Isn't there another word for that? I can't remember. My military bearing, I guess I lost it for a minute. But, convoys, there you go, convoy, that's the word I was looking for. So they'd have big convoys, you know, coming through there for whatever reason. And so they had to stay up there pretty close to that. And then the area that we were in, it was kind of secondary, so to speak, even though there were a lot of IEDs out there because they had to make sure to keep that route clear for supplies and dignitaries and that sort of thing. The EOD was out there. In fact, the day that I got blown up, we got a call to investigate a possible IED, and we were just going to go secure the site for the EOD. We feel like now, after, you know, I've talked to some of my guys on the ground then, and I talked to the S3, you know, my buddy that was the S3 then, he told me that they probably knew where we were, and they called to give us a location down the road, knowing about where, how we would travel, and there was an IED in between us and the reported site. And we started driving down Route Metallica, favorite band at that time, you know, and my Humvee literally erupted. It was about 700 pounds of explosives buried in the road, and it literally shredded my Humvee. Three of the four Humvee doors were blown off, and the entire top of the truck was blown off. I lost three friends. I survived. My driver survived. Very fortunate for that. Originally, right at the beginning, I was knocked unconscious for a little bit. Once I woke up, I did, well, you know what truck commanders do. I started trying to call up a radio report. I wasn't hearing anything on the hand mic. I knew I was hurt, but I didn't know how bad. But I could feel the flames around me. So I threw the hand mic down after I seen the cable was burnt completely off of it.
The truck's on fire right now, right?
Yeah, the truck was on fire still. And so, you know, as I woke up and I could feel the heat and the flames and everything. And they had already retrieved the driver while I was unconscious, but they left me in the truck because they thought I was dead, which the right thing to do, you know, triage. But once I started pushing on my door, the only door left on the truck, it was embedded in like that dirt and the asphalt from the explosion. The IED literally went off right behind the driver's seat. I don't know how it didn't kill me and the driver both, but I mean, literally right behind the driver. I could have put my hand over it. It was incredible. Looking at the photos and stuff. But I get out of the truck. I'm standing there and I'm just taking it all in, you know, because I know I'm hurt. I just don't know how bad yet. And I start barking orders because it seems like everybody's kind of chaotic. You know, everybody seemed to be running around and they're trying to take care of Adam. And Adam, he's a big guy like you, you know, and he's over there fighting. And, you know, he's in shock, basically. You know, I can see he's got his bones sticking out of his arm and got blood running everywhere. And I start barking orders, you know, I'm like, hey, start calling a 911, pull security, do this, do that. And everybody just stops and they're staring at me. And I figure some of it was because, for one, they thought I was dead. But later, when I first started working on the book, one of the guys that was on the ground told me, he said, bro, he said, you survived two blocks. He said it was the IED originally while I was unconscious in the vehicle, never attended to my driver. The AT-4 cooked off and caused a fireball inside the truck.
What's that?
What is that?
Rocket. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh,
wait. The AT-4, dude. And the IED. Were thinking, when the second blast happened, they were thinking, well, he's certainly dead now. And then there I was barking orders at everybody. You know, they probably didn't recognize me, you know, because the only way I know how I looked was once I got on the ground over there and they laid me on the ground and started CLS. One of my buddies came out to retrieve me because the bullets inside my truck were cooking off. And while I was standing there trying to take everything in, my body armor was on fire and the material was burning or melting and running down my leg. Plus, it was my ammo pouches. So, you know, that was another 200 plus bullets was about to start cooking off on me. So I get that body armor off, get that off, and I turn back around. And that was when he come out and grabbed me, because once I took my body armor off, he knew that, you know, he had to come help me. Otherwise, I was.
All right. So let me get this straight. They hit you with 700 pounds of TNT. They shot you with a rocket. And then they poured burning Kevlar down you and didn't kill you.
Oh, maybe I'm just stubborn.
What the hell you got inside that thing, man?
That is incredible. So say that again, an AT what?
Yeah, an AT-4, a law rocket.
An AT-4 is a rocket, it's a shoulder fired.
Well, yeah, it's in there. You shoot it. It's I guess, was it 4 feet long, 3 feet long, or something like that? Then
yeah, it's about 4 feet.
Yeah. Oh, we shoot them individually. It's a personal handheld carry. We have different levels of them.
It was in the Humvee.
It was in the Humvee, like in the back.
And then it went off because of the fire.
It got real hot and cooked off.
Got it.
So they,
got
it. It means it exploded. Right behind him. That thing's designed to hit away from you and kill you.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And you got to keep the backblast area clear. Blah,
yeah,
blah,
all that stuff.
You know, so it's got that shoots off the back. And I know that Marcus and Morgan both probably do this. Like, well, almost all military guys do. When you're watching a movie and you see somebody like, oh, watch out. And they pulled up like this, you know, rocket, handheld rocket, and everybody's standing behind them going, yeah, get them. And I'm like, bro, that's not good.
That's not how that goes. That's not how that is.
That's not real.
That's not right. The best are when they get the videos are when they fire in the goose off and you see them suckers flip out of the damn from the standing position. 1 minute they're there, and next minute there's a big, and it looks like a ninja when they throw that bomb down and the smoke comes up and they disappear. That's what happens to us. And if you fire that thing more than 3 times in a day, it'll literally separate your pericardial sac from your heart. That's what we do. Yeah. And guys fire 20 of them. Some bitches, I mean, they'll pass that thing around. That's how we get around it.
My gosh.
The stuff.
Okay. Never mind, man. Sorry. Y'all will go down a rabbit hole with that.
I can't believe they hit you with a rocket, too. So, that's a great story, bro.
Well, it cooked off. It cooked off.
That's the same thing.
Truck, so, you know.
That's what that is.
Default,
they shot
default.
You in the back of the seat. It's just like getting hit in the back of the seat with a damn law rocket. Yeah, bro. And that didn't kill you. I know what in the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm a medic. I know exactly what that is.
Nope.
That thing's not. It's designed to detonate 100 feet from you and kill you.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't realize. Yeah, that's right.
The blast area on that thing, depending on what it hit, it's a rocket. You're not supposed to shoot somebody with it.
Right.
You literally got shot in the back with it. That's where it was parked. Oh, that's pretty hardcore, man.
I was about to tell another story, but I don't want to get sidetracked because
don't get me fired up,
goal
dude,
today.
Sorry. Wait, okay. So what happened at that point when you take your body armor off and your friend comes to help you? Do you black out at that moment, or what's next?
I was awake all the way to Baghdad. And, you know, fortunately, this is where I believe in divine intervention. You know, honestly, I believe that God has a purpose for me. That's one of the reasons that I'm here. You know, because just as you said, Marcus, you know, this is, and I survived.
Well, that's absolutely correct.
It, against all odds, I would think, you know, in a lot of ways. So he comes out, he grabs me, gets me on the ground. There just happened to be a helicopter coming back, Black Hawk coming back from Baghdad, and happened to be in the area when they got the call. And they had enough fuel to grab us and then take us in. So me and my driver both, were the only two that were injured and the only two that was left. But as I was laying on the ground, I had been asking, you know, where are my friends? Where are my soldiers? Nobody was telling me. And maybe because they didn't think that it was the right time or something, whatever the case, or maybe they just didn't know at that moment. But one of the guys was blown out of the truck into the ditch. And they said it looked like he survived for a few moments. But the other two, you know, were pretty much... I mean, yeah. Anyway, but yeah. So the helicopter comes in. I can hear it coming, and I'm starting to try to gather myself. And as you said, you know, I was probably in my 30s about that time, and I think my maturity helped.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's: cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just so good, and the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have 80 to 120 milligrams of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
One of the conversations that I was having with my roommate, he was the acting platoon sergeant that day, and me and him were talking, and he was like, you're going to be okay, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I feel good, you know, I'm okay, I know I'm hurt, but yeah, everything's going to work out, you know, and I'm being optimistic. And then all of a sudden I got a glimpse of what I looked like in his glasses. Mm. And I could see that my face was charred black. My hair was gone. My ears were gone. My nose was gone. I had blood running out of everything. And I started panicking. Well, in the midst of me panicking, I could tell I was panicking. And I started pushing him away. And I knew I had to start pulling myself back together. And I'm like, okay, I got to assess this situation, you know. And I remember looking at this hand and I was thinking, you know, it's got to hurt, you know, but it really wasn't hurting yet. But I had a very selfish thought when I was looking at this hand. I was thinking, I better get a day off for this. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get a lot of days off when you're in combat.
Right.
So a lot of people are like, bro, I bet you really were thinking that. And I'm like, no, I really was. You know,
that's,
like,
that's a true story. I remember every time I get hurt and when the pain settles down, the first thought into my head always is I get to rest for a couple of days in the hospital. I swear that happens right? to me too. And I'm it's comfortable because like, hey, man, there's going to be people there bringing me something to eat, man. You know, I get to lay around. Same thing. I literally think it's a day off.
Yeah.
So like, that's not an odd thought. Don't worry about that. You're good. You're squared away, bro. there's more than one of us out there.
We get on the helicopter. We get on the Black Hawk, and we're headed in. My driver's with me, and we're talking. He don't know where anybody's at. He don't know where our guys are. I don't know where my guys are. So that's the only issue, you know, that we're really faced with at that moment, you know, that's bothering us. We get into the hospital at the green zone. He goes one way, I go the other. And while I'm in the OR, they're starting to cut my clothes off and scrubbing me down. And I remember asking, and I'd been asking everybody, I'm like, where's my guys? Where's my guys? And nobody would tell me. And then all of a sudden, Adam was gone, you know, my driver. And I'm like, where's my driver? And they're like, oh, he's fine. He's, you know, he's over in the other operating room. And anyway, we're trying to put all this together. Well, the last thing I remember is there was this doctor standing up above me. You know, I'm laying down on the bed. Or on the gurney, whatever it is, and they're prepping me, getting lines in me, and this, that, and the other. And I remember looking at him, and he was like the only person that made eye contact with me, which was finally, I was like, finally, somebody made eye contact. And he's like, you'll find out where your friends are in a couple of months. I had no idea what that meant, but at that moment, I was medically induced in a coma that I spent the next 48 days in, I believe. It was like 48 was the actual number. But as you know, and if you don't, I'll tell you, it's not like a light switch, you know, like, oh, I just wake up in the morning, you know, once they take you off all those meds, there's this gradual comeback. So even that whole year, I was so heavily medicated that I don't really have a timeline of events, but I have a cornerstone. There's a cornerstone of what I was faced with. And it was when they came into my hospital room and this day they said, Sergeant Harris, today we want you to take 10 steps. I was like, 10 steps? I was like, man, I'm a combat soldier. I'm all in this hospital. Just getting out of bed was excruciating. The pain, it hurt in every bone, every joint, every muscle. And I was thinking, nope, I'm not doing it. And I really did quit before I started the fight. And that's what's sad about that. But I went about 3 days like that. And there were good people coming in to talk to me, physical therapists, occupational, blah, 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 you name it, right? All these different departments. And everybody's like, we really need you to do the work. We really need you to do this. And I was thinking, nope, not going to do it. It's too hard, too painful. And then one morning, my mom came in. We were having breakfast, and she had to feed me because my arms were still out in airplane splints, you know, which means my arms were literally stuck straight out. And she came in, and she was feeding me, and we're talking. She was rubbing my feet because that was the only thing she could touch. Everything else was covered in bandages or stitches, you know, one or the other. And
so you're from head to toe like covered, right? You're from head to like from ahead. From the movies. You're head to toe covered in white bandages with your arms flayed out.
Like a mummy.
Like a mummy, right?
Like a mummy, exactly. Head all the way down to my feet. And I remember she kept telling me, she's like, your family needs you. Your family needs you. I was like, I'm here. And she's like, no, we need you to do the work. And I'm like, yeah, I'll get to it. Well, after she left, a few minutes later, my dad came in. And my dad, he was short, blonde-headed guy, had like these steel, cold blue eyes. And he just stands at the foot of the bed, and he's just standing there with his arms crossed looking at me. And this goes on literally for like 20, 30 seconds, you know. And he's just standing there eyeballing me. And I'm like, okay, what is it? I know you got something to say. He kept waiting, kept drawing it out. And then all of a sudden he said, are you done, soldier? I was like, excuse me, sir? Are you done, soldier? And it just washed over me. I had like this just wash, like, holy crap. I'm a quitter before I even tried to start the fight. Where did my pride go? And I realized right then I was not done. And I said, no, sir, I am not. And he turned around and walked out of the room and didn't say another word. and left me with my thoughts. And I was thinking, yeah, I better get back to work. So
father's the worst. Just thinking of
perspective, when somebody actually asks you that question, are you done? No, I'm not. Well, then get up and get busy. Do what you're supposed to do to fix you. And I think you probably know that more than most.
Oh, it's the worst. When the old man drops that on you. You know what I'm talking about? Steely eye, and they just stand there and look at you. It's the worst, man. Yeah, I remember that part.
Were you married at that time?
I was married. I was. And she's still a wonderful woman. I give her a lot of kudos because she worked really hard to get me through a very long, hard recovery. Unfortunately, we just couldn't ever come back as a couple, you know, and we could see that our animosity towards each other was affecting other people. And we made a decision, you know, and anyway, but we're still really close. We're good friends. We don't agree on everything, but, you know, for the most part, we get along and we have an opportunity to share with each other every now and then. And I think she did this on purpose. Since me, I'm Army. She married a damn Marine.
There you go.
I said, did you do that on purpose? But I really like him too. I call him my husband-in-law.
You know, it's a uniform. It's their freaking uniform, man.
It's bastards. Oh my gosh. So you would say your parents really were your just guiding light through all of that, even though your dad didn't do it in a loving way. He definitely got you out of bed.
Then in his fatherly way. That's, yeah, his fatherly that's what it's supposed way. To be.
Yeah.
And I'm really supposed to like
sometimes
that.
Sometimes we need tough love. And I think that's actually something before we came on the air, that was something that we started talking about is, you know, the how I don't want to say a lack of it nowadays, but I think in a way there is a lack of tough love. You know, people are scared to express their opinions and stand by their beliefs because they don't want to hurt somebody's feelings or be canceled, so to speak. But there is a difference between social media bullying and I think the things that we experienced when we were younger, for the simple fact that the internet, it's like it's endless possibilities of people mocking you. Whereas when you're younger, like when we were younger, we didn't have to compete with the internet, so to speak. It was like the people that were right in front of us. And then for the most part, it's like me, if I had a situation, you know, we handled it.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Well, I mean, I talk to a lot of our guys, and even some team guys, and they'll read something online and it says somebody talks some smack. I was like, dude, that's like watching a commercial and telling you that you're fat so you'll buy their damn diet pill.
Yeah.
Like, what are you even talking about? It's probably not even a real damn person. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not even a real person. That's why God doesn't win. It's just like any other game. It's our virtual game. You can jump in that sucker and you're a player in there. You're an influencer. Everyone's got titles and names. Everyone wants to get away from titles and names. And the only way you can do that is to add more names and titles. That's just the way it is. I mean, that's human nature. So remember what it is that when you're playing with it. Look, we didn't have it, so that's how I know. And if you're born into a world where that's always there, then it's a part of it. I don't understand. I see it. I can comprehend what's going on, but, you know, we just got to learn.
How long did it take you to recover, to take those 10 steps? How long was it after that?
You know, that is a great follow-up because I didn't quite go there. I wanted to give you guys an opportunity to come back with some feedback. But, yeah, when my dad left, you know, and I take that back. He did say something. And when he left, when he walked out of the room, he literally just looked at me and he said, then get your ass up and start doing the work. And I did, you know, I had to. And it was not easy, of course, but I did turn those 3 steps because the first time I went to take a walk, well, I mean, it was just excruciating, right? And I had 3 little tiny shuffles and that was it. And then when he came in and put me in perspective, I turned those 3 steps into 10, 10 to 20 and so on. And it wasn't easy. I mean, it took weeks, of course, weeks and maybe even a couple of months. But intense physical therapy, literally that was my job at the time, was going back and forth to physical therapy to get my mobilities back and start building my strength back. But once I started doing really well, but the recovery itself, it was probably 2 years, 3 years. And that was back-to-back surgeries, you know, going back and forth to the doctor almost every day, every week for sure at some point. But to date, I've had about 80 surgeries.
Nice.
Been very blessed, though.
Wow,
we actually celebrated
the
80th.
That's a good one, bro.
It's not something that I ever wanted a record in, but, you know, I feel like a
nice job. You got it. That's a good one.
Some of the other burn guys, though, that I went through my recovery with, man, we're talking like 100
oh,
so
yeah.
surgeries.
Oh, yeah. We got 100
I'm just
plus.
Like, oh, my God.
Those are over tiers. Yeah. If you get 100 surgeries, it's like getting 100 on your test. You know what I'm talking about? And then they go into those 115s. You're like, you're just showing off. That kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Freaking guys. Or something, man.
I got to where I was doing like a multi-department thing. So it's like, if I knew I had a surgery from this department and a surgery from that department, I would try to plan it to where both the departments would be there. One working up top, one working down low, whatever the case was. So that way it's one recovery. And I don't know if that actually helped me minimize the number of surgeries that I had. They seemed to like the idea at first when I mentioned it. They were like, well, I don't know. And I was like, I think it'd be better, you know, because this isn't really going to affect that. And if I'm going to be down anyway, I might as well have it all done at once. And then that way I have one recovery. And it seemed to work out pretty well.
So the way they delivered me with it was the fact that it's like, hey, it's not a recovery. This is your new beginning. So, and all my surgeries were kind of like the $1 million man, Steve. Like every time I'd lay me down, whatever you're doing to me is making me stronger. I didn't come back the same, right? I've been modified extensively. So, the way it explained was pretty good too. So, like, when we're first born and babies are the size they are for a reason, they can't complain, they can only scream. And when you get older, this comes into play too. We stop sitting down on the ground. Like, the furthest you'll usually go is to a chair or to your bed. Very rarely do we go all the way down. Well, you lose those muscle abilities. So when you get hurt, start working out is sit down on the ground, stand up. Do everything a baby and a child does because you're basically starting over. And you tighten up those muscles on the inside so your exterior muscles don't crush them. You got to think, a lot of times our babies are crying because their muscles are sore. I've used them for the first time. I can't even imagine what that feels like.
No, that's a good point.
You know
I didn't
what I mean?
Think about that.
Yeah, I didn't either until they said it to me that way. And I was like, okay, so when I'm not recovering, I'm starting over. Well, I'll start from scratch. I got to start by one step. I did the one step too. And you forget how hard it is because we jump out of bed so damn fast. Hell, in the military, you flip out of bed or get flipped out of bed, and then you're ready to eat and run 3 miles. That's unbelievable. You know what I mean? Remember that? I always roll to my side. I have to pick myself. I've done it so many times that I'll do it in my sleep. And that's just because that was the new way I had to move. And when they taught it to me like that, they were like, hey, look, man, we started you over. But we upgraded your systems. I was like, okay, roger that. Cool.
Well, you know, I like that. And, you know, it was. Melanie, when you asked how long, you know, that recovery was, I guess in a way it is going to be ongoing.
Right.
You know, probably for a lot of us, you know, like a maintenance issue, you know, going in for getting a little tune-up, getting my bolts tightened up. And I want to say
that's
I'm
brilliant.
Modified too because
nice
I got the spockers.
Nice job, bro. Frank, getting your bolts tightened up. You hear what that man just said to me? That's a good one, man.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you're injured like that, it is a lifelong recovery in constant maintenance for the duration of your life. You'll have that, but I was just wondering, while you were at BAMC, what that recovery was like, and didn't you receive stem cells that was fairly new online when you were there?
You're talking about the stem cell, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the stem cell technology that was actually one of my dad's recommendations because, you know, big sci-fi fan here, Star Wars, Trek, you know, Star Trek. And anyway, my dad, he was walking around the hospital and I don't know how he came across it, but he saw some sign that was like stem cell research department or something like that. Because as you know, BAMC is one of the medical research, one of the best medical research centers, you know, for burn survivors and that sort of thing. But they also got the Institute for Medical Research right there on campus, and they do all kinds of wonderful things. Well, so the stem cell research, I talked to my doctor about it, and I was like, hey, you know, what's the stem cell research about? How do I go about volunteering for it? And one thing led to another. And boy, they had me in an OR because they were pretty excited. I was actually one of the very first individuals to attempt regenerative growth, meaning we were trying to regrow this finger here, which it did okay, but before I had it removed now, but before it was like a little stubby finger, you know, that was cut off. And they kept applying the stem cell three different times, and we tried three different things to encourage bone and tissue growth. Although they knew that they could grow tissue, a lot of it was already using regenerative tissues such as liver, heart, lung, you know, or stuff like that, you know, that would regenerate on its own. And the stem cell just encouraged the growth faster. Well, I was doing the tissue on this finger, and we had a hard time getting the bone because the tissue grew back so fast. Yet we did have some success. It grew, the bone grew about, I think it was an eighth of an inch. And we grew about a half inch of tissue.
This is while you're wearing it? This is, you're talking about on your hand?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Right here on,
so what
are
they,
on this finger.
What's the concept
and they were hoping
it
that it would lead into something else.
Well, how, think about how hard that is. You're wearing it around while it's trying to do its experiment. What do they do now? Do they grow it in a lab and then attach it? Is that how they do it now? Do they grow the whole thing in the lab and then attach it?
No.
So
they were applying it to that stub. So that I would have to go in, they'd have to cut the top of it and like cone it out.
Right.
Fill it up with stem cell and then, you know, cover it up. One of the issues was is that we couldn't get the bone to grow fast enough, or we couldn't leave the stem cell on it long enough without it healing in order to actually encourage.
Well, yeah.
The bone growth.
Were you moving around?
Yeah. I mean,
well, that's why
they just kept it covered.
Oh no,
yeah,
no.
They
no.
just kept it covered.
Yeah.
So
normally
it wasn't really functional.
Yeah. You got to have that hand immobilized for that to work. The minute you
Pretty
move
much.
That thing, it'll come as a foreign object.
Right. Well, then that was part of the issue too. So I had to go into the clinic almost every day and they would check it, reapply stem cell. And that's why I said, since I was the first person to try it, there were trial and error, so to speak. Well, after the third surgery, I was like, kind of like that, you know, talking about the mobility and stuff, because I had to always keep it up. I had to keep it in a fairly comfortable position to make sure that it was trying to grow and develop without disturbing it.
That's unbelievable that did that.
Yeah, about 2 months of that. And I was like, I'm done. Because I was like, y'all going to have to find another guinea pig. I was like, I'm done. But
the fact that
we had some mild success.
The fact that it grew an eighth of an inch while you were manipulating it and moving it around in an environment exposed to the elements, everything the elements designed to attack it, and it still grew like that is a promising, very promising.
Well,
and you had that in a controlled environment.
Well, that research turned into something else, though. The doctor that was pioneering the stem cell research there at that time was Dr. Stephen Wolf. And what they've done is they've turned it into like a spray gel now. And instead of burn survivors and other people that need to have donor sites, like taking the good skin and putting it over burn sites, they use that paste now instead of taking skin. And that paste encourages the skin growth faster.
Oh, awesome.
So that way they don't have to do the donor.
It's only a matter of time.
So
that sir comes in a spray bottle. Are you kidding
me?
You get a burn, dude. You can go to the store and get a spray bottle. And
oh yeah.
What? I mean, that's where that's going. That's exactly. Once we get that starts happening, and you can see that. And for what you said is on point too with BAMSI, and it's the premier. That's because we're there.
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, it is an experiment, a trial and error, but war is horrible. But you got to understand what also comes out of that. Us, we come out of that. And then our people
Absolutely.
In their environments try to better us because they're presented with us. And some people look, I mean, like, hey, this is the way we advance. It's through guys like us, man. So that's unbelievable. That stem cell thing with its growing while you were manipulating it was amazing.
Yeah, that's really incredible. I mean, yeah, it might not have worked what the goal was for you, but by seeing how fast your tissue grew with that, they were able to...
Yeah.
pivot and help other people. So from now on, when there's really bad scar tissueing, they can just use
that's only a matter of time.
Yeah, they can use that instead. That's crazy.
I mean, you kind of want to go get an abrasion. You want to go get
scuffed
up. I was thinking the way the human body works. If you go scuff it up and you remove some unwanted part of it, and then you got that spray over and it comes back brand new. I mean, there's a use. Yeah,
I hadn't actually seen the end results, but I got to looking it up one day because I was getting ready for an interview and I was going to try to have an article. And I come across that where it showed that they were coming out with that paste. And I was like, holy cow. And you know, that was several years ago. So
right.
I'm sure that it's probably advanced even
bro,
more now.
Every day. Melly and I ran an event the a while back where this lady, she said something on stage. She goes, technology will never be as slow as it is right now. Which means every second that sucker speeds up.
Yep.
And
the stuff you bought last week is already obsolete, I'm sure.
Right. And how about like when it comes to tech, people are like, hey, what's good? Should I use this? I was like, if it was built in 2015 and after, it is so high speed that it's unbelievable. And even the things that we would come online in the early 2000s and like, hey, yeah, is it good? I'm like, it's all good. It's all brilliant stuff, man. It's just you can see the generational difference between it. It's funny, man.
Well, Shiloh,
we kept you long enough, man. We're good.
What are you doing now, and how can we help promote whatever you've got going on? How can people find you?
Well, thank you very much for asking. And, I just want to take a moment to step back to the stem cell. You know, I just became a yes guy, and this is going to lead into what I'm doing now. I didn't intend on being a motivational speaker. I didn't intend on being an author. I didn't intend on a lot of this stuff, you know. And in fact, early on in that recovery, you know, after my whole dad incident where he's asking me, are you done? I realized that I wasn't done, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do because my entire business plan was stay in the military until I can retire and then get out of the military and go to work at some high-speed job like FBI or CIA or something. I mean, literally, that was my whole idea. That was my career plan. And then when something like this happens, you know, I had to recalibrate everything. And I didn't really know what to do. I didn't know what my calling was. As I was walking around the hospital one day, I walked into a conference room, and there was a group of people there. I thought I was just looking for my doctor's office, and I thought that was it. And I popped in. And basically, I was in front of everybody. They were all facing. And then the lady that was presenting, she turned around and she was like, oh, are you our guest speaker? And I was like, I'm not, but I can be, kind of joking around. And I really was joking. I had no idea anything about speaking. And she goes, well, do you have a couple minutes? And I'm like, I'm actually looking for my doctor's office. And I was like, I do have a few minutes. Well, we sat in there and did some Q&A. One thing led to another. They liked what I said. They liked my flow. And somebody asked me if I'd speak an event. And that is literally how it started.
Yeah.
That event led to another event and then another event and then another event. And I just kept saying yes, because it felt like I was serving the community. It felt like I was still serving, you know, my wounded friends that don't wear their scars the same way that I do. And, you know, there's so many times that, you know, with me having the scars on the outside, and I'll be in a group of veterans, and people will come up and say, thank you so much for your service. And I'm like, thank you very much. And these are my friends, you know, because I have to bring them in because I feel like that's one of God's purposes for me. So, yeah, I've been speaking. I authored a book, and I didn't even know that I wanted a book. But I met a writer. Her brother was an ex-Green Beret. He and I got along really well. They put us together. We wrote a book called Still Will. I might have sent you guys a copy. I'm supposed to send you a copy, but I'd be happy to send you a copy. We wrote the book, and then one thing's led to another. I've done this, I've done that, and I've been so very blessed. When COVID happened, you know, we lost a lot of work, of course, you know, and kind of recalibrated. So I went back to school for a little while. I've been getting into ministry some. I really enjoy ministry. I really enjoy religion in general for the simple fact that, as you probably know as well, faith, regardless of what it is, can get you through your worst days, your darkest moments. And one thing that I really like about Team Never Quit is because Team Never Quit and what the Luttrell family stands for is exactly what my dad told me, or what he asked me. Are you done, soldier? And I think that that's the question that all of us that have ever donned a uniform should ask ourselves. Are we done? Are we really done right now? What happened to your pride? What happened to your mission? What happened to your calling? Are you going out there and living your best life? that's the question that I think that everybody needs to ask themselves is, am I done in this moment? But I can tell you, and I know that you can too, from Team Never Quit, you're not done. And if you can't quit, you have to keep pushing forward.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. Thank you so much, brother, for coming on and talking to everybody.
I have two follow-up questions that I just am out of pure curiosity. Is your dad still alive?
No.
No. Oh, I'm so sorry. And what happened
Good question, though.
What happened to Adam?
I love Adam to death and much respect. He came to visit me a couple of times. And then one of the recent times that we spoke, he said, Shiloh, he said, I love you. He said, but I need my space. He said, I'm trying to leave all that behind me. Because he was a young guy. You know, he came straight out of high school, got his TA-50, got sent to Iraq. A couple of months later, he's blown up and he's got to figure out, you know, what the hell he's going to do with the rest of his life. Young guy. And, you know,
he get banged up pretty bad. He get burned up pretty bad.
Yeah, he got banged up pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of challenges that he had. And it's not for me to talk about those. That's his personal stuff. But, you know, he did. He had some injuries, you know, and challenges that he had to face. And he's in a good place right now.
Oh, good.
And that's all that matters to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Enjoy the rest of it.
Yes.
We'll be in touch, man.
Thank you, guys.
God bless you.
Yeah, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on, Shiloh. And we'll see you guys next week.